The digital distributed online chaos will now present you no POC, no fix, a sad story about Bluetooth security. So, POC here stands for proof of concept and not people of color. It's about technology. It's just a broken mem copy in the Bluetooth stack, and do we really need to fix that? So that's probably what the Bluetooth developer thought, and Jan Ruge is talking about what he found out about it. So to Jan.
Hi, my name is Jan Ruge, and as Lindworm said before, my talk is no POC, no fix, and I want to present some additional IT security findings that we had in the Bluetooth stack, and I want to tell you something about the vulnerabilities as well as our methodology, and also something about the disclosure process that we had with those vendors. So first of all, my motivation why I want to do this. During my time at university, there was a NextOne firmware patching project, as Yiska mentioned before, and it was targeting Broadcom Wi-Fi controllers. So the main idea was that we can implement the monitor mode on the Nexus 5, what wasn't possible before. So they built this whole patching framework around it so that we have access to the firmware and can modify it. And as a consequence, others use this knowledge to build exploits against those Wi-Fi controllers. Most prominent is a Broadpone exploit by Google Project Zero. And other one was by Quark's lab in April 2019. So this is always something you have to keep in mind if you do reverse engineering and make your knowledge public. Others might you will use it to write exploits. And those are, of course, only the public known exploits. There might be even others that we don't know about. So currently at SIMU, there is a lot of research going on regarding Broadcom Bluetooth controllers, as you heard before. There's an internal group project that adds debugging capabilities to the to those Bluetooth controllers, and we are currently having there the same problem that we have making a lot of knowledge about the controllers publicly available, and so we wanted to have a look before others do if there are some obvious vulnerabilities. So first of all, a little bit of background. So most of you already heard of Bluetooth. It's a radio protocol. It operates at 2.4 gigahertz. And it's usually used for communication between two devices or more devices. So, for example, your mobile phone communicating with the headset. And what some people might not know is that when you have a mobile device with Bluetooth just enabled, you can connect to it per default. So, for example, you can run L2 ping, what will open up an L2 cap connection and run ping commands over it. And this is, of course, a huge attack surface if you can interact with nearby devices without them even noticing. And in addition, there are some protocols that are hidden or terminated in the firmware, so they are not accessible from the host. And those are quite poorly documented, and the implementation is not public, so those are also prone to errors. And the platform that we use, I guess Yiska already showed it to you, is this Cypress development board. If you say Cypress or Broadcom, I use the terms basically as the same vendor because Cypress has acquired a Broadcom wireless stuff a couple of years ago, so the copyright in the firmware is also Broadcom. And yeah, as I said, we use those Bluetooth Low Energy development boards because you can run C code on them. So you have this WISED development environment and can execute your C code on the controller. And most interesting here is that there is no separation between the application that runs on the controller and the firmware. So you can read all memory regions, you can read the RAM, you can read the ROM, and even interact with it. In addition, the firmware somehow has to link the C code against the code that is stored in the ROM so that you can use primitives from the already existing firmware. And so the development environment basically leaks function names, global variables, and hardware register names for everything, and what made our reverse engineering progress a lot faster. So now a little bit about the Bluetooth protocols that are relevant here. So on the right we have a diagram. On the top there is the host, and the bottom here, this big thing is the firmware. And here you can see there's the L2 CAP protocol I mentioned before. It's basically the lowest layer that can be used to communicate between two devices. And this L2 CAP protocol is then wrapped into HCI, whereas HCI is a communication protocol used for the host to speak to the firmware. And for the firmware itself, you have here on top the hardware re registers for the serial interface. And then this blue stuff over here is the multi-threaded firmware. So there runs a real-time operating system on the firmware, implementing multiple threads. And here on the top, there's a BT transport thread, what is responsible for parsing HCI messages. And yeah, this then we have here the link manager that processes those HCI messages and also implements the link manager protocol, what is the protocol I mentioned before that is already terminated in the firmware and not accessible to the host. And this link manager also controls something that is called a Bluetooth core scheduler. And this is an additional component developed by Broadcom, so it's a custom scheduler. And this scheduler is involved for each Bluetooth clock cycle, what is around about 300 microseconds. So this interrupt handler here on the bottom is invoked 3,000 times a second. And this Bluetooth core scheduler implements all the time critical tasks for the Bluetooth protocol. And now I'm a little bit more of background. So as I mentioned before, there's the internal Brew project that you can use for debugging the firmware. And as the project was developed first, they were working on the Nexus 5, so they didn't have any symbols, and they're just doing it by plain reverse engineering. And even though they were able to get access to the Link Manager protocol and extract those messages and also send arbitrary messages. And in this talk, I want to talk about Frankenstein, which is an emulating and C patching framework. And this is also what was used to review the Bluetooth core scheduler. And why is this important? Because if you have a look at a Bluetooth packet, this is how it looks on the physical layer. In the beginning, you have the channel access code, what is basically a link identifier between two devices. Then you have the packet header. That describes basically the type of the packet. Is this a management packet? Is this a data packet? And then there is a payload header, what describes some flow control stuff and a length field. And in the end, you have finally the payload. So if you have no or don't know about the Bluetooth core scheduler, you only have access to the payload. For example, if you're coming from the host, you can set arbitrary L2 CAP packets. And if you can send LMP packets, you can send management packets with arbitrary payload. But as we now have also access to those packet and payload header, we can basically send arbitrary packets. And in this talk, the payload header will be most important because this triggered some interesting bugs. So main technique that we used was hooking. So as I said before, we can execute C code on the controller. So we built a custom hooking algorithm, hooking me mechanism, so we can easily debug the firmware. For example, we can trace function calls, extract the arguments that are used to call this function. And in addition, we used it to implement some attacks because we needed to modify the protocol behavior on the link manager protocol level, and also used it for fuzzing. And yeah, what we did pretty early in the process was we found the function that is responsible to copy the payload data to the send buffer, to the hardware send buffer. And so we basically set a hook on this function. And at this point, we can modify the packet and payload header and even the payload and therefore implements fuzzing. And this is how it looks like in practice. So this is actually the code here. We have this function here, BCS DMR TX enable EIR, what is basically the function that copies extended inquiry response packets to the send buffer. And extended inquiry response packets are the response if you're doing a device inquiry, so if you are scanning two devices. And this is the response packet. It has run about 240 bytes of data. So it was quite interesting because there fits a lot of data into it. And this here on the bottom is the actual fuzzing function that is invoked prior to this copy. And all it does is randomize the Bluetooth address. So the scan results are not as fast or not discarded. And here we are simply just flipping random bits in the payload header. And yeah, that's it. So I flashed the code on the controller. I set it to discoverable and started scanning with my laptop. And boom, it crashed actually the controller of my old T430. And okay. So the problem here is that it's the T430 is a very old laptop. The firmware is from around about 2010. We are not actually that sure because it has no build date in it. We tried the same technique against newer devices, and newer is Nexus 5, so even quite old devices, and they seem not to be affected. So I thought, it's probably not worth the effort, but Jiska said, maybe you should have a look anyway. So, okay, I looked at it, and yeah, I had no symbols for the firmware, so it was a quite hard time to figure out what's going on. At some point, I had the full firmware image, had an image of the crash, and it looks like that it was a heap corruption because we can look from where we come from, and as you see, that there are some functions involved that are relevant for the heap. And this is quite problematic because on this particular heap implementation, if you have a buffer overflow, you're basically corrupting some pointer somewhere, and then you free the buffer and everything is fine, and somewhere later you are trying to access those corrupted data and then it crashes. So it is basically impossible to correlate the crash with the cause of the crash. So we had no luck with this one, so we gave up and focused more on the emulation part of our research. And yeah, the basic idea here is that the firmware is just ARM code, and we can just extract a well-defined firmware state that contains all the registers or the memory, and just restore the registers and try to re-execute it maybe. And this is here on the right is the code how we did this. So we have this XMIT state function that can be also invoked as a hook. And all it does is it saves the registers to the stack and stores the stack pointer at a fixed location in memory. And then we are calling the XMIT memory function that will actually disable all the interrupts, so we have no other code running in the meantime. And then we are sending all the memory regions that we want to the host. And this is important that we do not use functions that use threading, for example, invoking the BT transport thread. So we just directly use the hardware registers to send out the memory dump. And if we have now the memory dump on the host, we can basically call the continue function. And this will restore, first of all, the stack pointer and load the registers and continue execution. And yeah, let's see how far we can get with it. But first of all, we have the memory dump, and of course we don't have the hardware registers anymore. We have no UART, the radio front end isn't implemented, so we have to do some modifications to the firmware first of all. And here's how we did this. So we just wanted to use plain QEM or ARM, we didn't want to implement or to mess up with QEMO. And so first of all, we have here the firmware where we extract our memory dumps, and those are then converted to object files. And as I said, we need to do some modifications. We want to write C code. The C code lives in the same memory as the same address space as the firmware. So we also can compile this to an object file. And as I said before, we have a full list of all functions of all global variables, etc. So what we can do is we can link our C code against the firmware image that is stored in the that we extracted from the chip. So we can basically write C code in the same address space. So we can invoke functions, we can parse data structures, and so on. And in the end, after we have compiled everything, we can link it to a new ELF file. And the ELF file then describes the memory layout, of course, of the firmware. And down here's an extra page where our C code lives. And the C code, first of all, does some modifications to the ROM and to the RAM. And then second, it calls the continue function and restores those registers. And first of all, what we did is we added a lot of debug messages so that we can trace function calls which are invoked in order to understand what is going on. And in the end, we were able to implement the threading behavior. We were able to inject and extract HCI messages, and we are also able to inject and extract raw wireless frames. So what we can do right now is, as we can make use of HCI, we can try to attach it to a running operating system and feed basically data to standard in that are then processed by the firmware as it were valid wireless frames, and then see how the firmware behaves together with the operating system and see what's going on. And this is what I want to quickly show you in a demo. I hope it works. So I have here an Ubuntu, and as you can see here, I have the. I am, let me make. Okay, that's better. I have here the Bluetooth settings of Ubuntu open. There's currently no adapter. Here I have the BTmon running, so we can see what's going on the HCI level. And here is a watch on HCI config and. That currently there's no adapter. And here on the top, there is the magic happening. So this HCI attached binary is actually the compiled firmware that we can run, and it will automatically attach to the Bluetooth stack. And we now pass random data into the compiled firmware and see how the system behaves. And as soon as I execute it, we can first of all see that we've got a lot of logs. Here's activity going on in the BTmon. We have a new adapter here that is now up and running. And sooner or later, the firmware actually starts a device inquiry and scans for devices, and we get actually valid scan results. So the random data that we are passing to the firmware are interpreted as wireless frames. And if we have a look here in BTmon, we can see here event device found, another device found, and yeah, of course, we get also a lot of logs, and I hopefully. Damn it. Demo time doesn't work. But, anyways. Let me start it again. Scanning for devices. Yeah, no matter. Yeah, as you can see, we get a lot of logs. And what I also told you that we can re-execute a firmware state. And so in this case, we have here also a web front end where I can execute the firmware and get even more insights into it. And So here I have a compiled firmware state that will just execute the firmware and until it enters the idle state. So here we have the debug output. And as you can see, we have here information about the context switches, memory allocations, and so on. We can also get here a view of the memory where we can see what memory regions are modified and also all the symbols. And on the bottom, we have a activity map of the memory, where we can see what memory regions are executed, which are read, which are written. And you can zoom into here, and there are also symbol annotations for the firmware. So, sorry that the demo didn't work quite out, because what actually happened is this here, because in the device inquiry there's actually a bug, and so there's a heap corruption, and the firmware should actually crash at some point with a heap corruption detected. And this here is what you would see on the console. So we have added a heap sanitizer to it, and somewhere get receive memory. Here's it. We can see that we here have a memory allocation with hex 109 bytes, and it's returned this address here. And later we are doing a memcopy into this actual buffer with a length that is way longer than the 600 and longer than the 109 bytes. And this is then detected by the heap sanitizer and gives us information actually where the heap overflow happened with all the link registers, so we can actually debug the firmware. And this was an actual CVE that we have reported. And it is, a heap corruption during the device inquiry. And as we had a closer look to it, it was actually the same bug as on the T430. So the problem here is that we have a bug within the firmware that we can observe on a firmware from 2010. And on a firmware that is from 2018. So it was at least for 8 to 10 years in production, this bug. And most interesting here is that the bug is actually located in two different locations. One is inside the Bluetooth core scheduler, and the other is in the link manager. And if you have a look at the source code, what is happening here, we are first of all extracting the packet length from the payload header by discarding the lower 3 bits and then masking out the length field. And in the link manager thread, we are allocating 264 bytes of memory. And then we are doing a mem copy into this buffer with a previously computed length. And what you might ask is here, okay, first of all, a length check is missing. What happens if we send data that is, or a packet that is longer than the expected 240 bytes? And the answer is actually nothing will happen, because the maximum packet size is limited on the physical layer. But what's the deadly bug here is that the bit mask over here is wrong. It's 13 bits, not 10 bits, as it should be. So the packet length also includes the reserve for future use field. And this field is normally set to 0. And as soon as you set a single bit into the field to 1, you greatly exceed the maximum packet size, and therefore trigger a buffer overflow. Okay, so you might ask, I can have a mem copy with that causes overflow, but I can't actually control the data that I'm overflowing with. So what's the point here? But in fact, if we have a closer look at the firmware, what we did is we used a pattern for the payload data that we could easily recognize in memory. So here on the bottom, you can see the blue part is the actual packet that we send. And for some reason, we don't know even why, some part of the packet is actually duplicated in the end. So even though we're only sending 240 bytes of memory, we can get a controlled overflow here. And this is pretty dangerous on the SIBL implementation, because if you have a look here, this is how the heap looks like. It's basically just a management of buffers with a fixed size. So we have here a free list of, or a linked list of all the free buffers. And if we have an overflow, we can corrupt one of those pointers and basically redirect the linked list to an arbitrary location memory. So what you can then do is you can treat any arbitrary memory location as a valid buffer if we are able to allocate three buffers in a row. And then therefore we can overwrite arbitrary data. And as there are no exploit mitigations at all, so the complete memory is writable and executable, we have a write-what-where gadget. We can basically overwrite a function in RAM and therefore gain code execution. And if you think about ASRR, forget about it. It's all static layout, so really no exploit mitigations at all. So we built a full proof of concept for this and then disclosed it to Broadcom. So on April last year, we informed them finally. And after 2 weeks, we requested a status update and asked what's going on. And they said that they have found this bug in February 2018 and they had a complete fix, informed all their customers, and there's a software upgrade available, and so everything is fine. And this is a pretty strong poker face here, because, well, our latest snapshot from the firmware was January 2018. And they stated that the bug that was for at least 8 years within the in the firmware was fixed 2 weeks later. So we had a closer look on this, because I was pretty sure that I have tested the Samsung Galaxy A3 with a patch level that was after February 2018. And later we also tested the Samsung Galaxy S8. What has a patch level from March 2019, what was quite recent at that point in time. And in fact, we tested even more devices and we couldn't find any device that actually was not vulnerable. So even some fitness tracker were vulnerable. And so we asked what's going on, and they said, yeah, we normally provide fixes to our customers, and yeah, it's at their discretion if they want to fix a bug or not. So, yeah, as I said, we couldn't find any device that was patched until Jiska bought the S10e. And here's a relevant part of the code. So here's the memcopy again. And they have indeed added a length check. So they are checking here if the length is greater than expected 240 bytes. And if it's the case, they are truncating it. And this firmware has a build date from April 2018, so they indeed found the bug in February, so this is this is legit. But yeah, well, in the end we had to escalate it to the vendors, so we contacted Google and we contacted Apple, because they are using, or at least Apple is using, Broadcom Bluetooth chips, and the Samsung also of course are using Android as well. And so Android supplied fixed or firmware images with this fix in August 2019, and also Apple provided fixes and gave us public recognition. And yeah, this was pretty stressful disclosure, as we had to really ask the vendors, please could you supply a fix to finally for a remote code execution that is in the firmware for over 10 years. That's not the way how it should be. So now I want to talk a little bit about ACL, or asynchronous connectionless. What is the term for Bluetooth connections? So fuzzing ACL is of course an interesting target, because it's the most complex task, or the most complex, yeah, thing in the firmware, because this also includes the link manager protocol implementation in the link manager. So we really expected some bugs here, especially because Yiska already found a missing length check in this handler table. So we tried actually a lot. So we tried coverage guided fuzzing with the Bluetooth stack attached. We tried coverage guided fuzzing on ACL packets, but this didn't yield any results because the ACL packets are directly passed to the BT transport thread, and therefore they do not they are not processed by the link manager. And we also tried the same like for the inquiry packets, where we mutated the packets before they are written to the hardware registers. And none of those approaches yielded any useful bugs. So we were not able to crash the firmware, which was quite surprising to us. But except there was one crash we could observe on the Nexus 5. And this was during my thesis, but the problem here was A, it wasn't in scope because I wrote my thesis on dynamic firmware analysis, and therefore the Android operating system was not in scope. I hadn't really time to debug this. In addition, our build here had no symbols, so what makes it even worse. And then we are in a heavily threaded process. As you can see here, we are crashing in thread number 19. So I gave up on this and stated in my thesis that it's probably the fragmentation exploit described by Bluebone. But later we actually retested it and throw the same fuzzer against the S10e, and actually, yeah, we could there also observe a crash, but we basically forgot about it. And as you can see, we have here finally also symbols, so we are crashing in a memcopy, what looks good on the first hand. But if you have a look here on X2, what was during invocation the length parameter of the memcopy, it looks pretty much like a negative number. And the fault address here with a lot of zeros in the end also indicates, or is a strong indication, that we are having here a memcopy with a negative number, what is an infinite memcopy, so we are running at the end of a page and therefore crash. And if you have a look at this reassemble and dispatch function, we can see here that there is indeed a memcopy with a difference in the length argument. And if you have a if you roll the numbers, there's indeed an edge case where you can cause a memcopy with a negative length. What is caused by this if statement, what is actually a buffer overflow protection. So, okay, this is a valid case. But as we tried further fuzzing and see what crashes we could generate, there are some crashes that we couldn't really explain. For example, this one, where the fault address looks really odd, like even as we have overwritten it with some ASCII, and it's a completely different code location, and all those crashes are were not reproducible. And so yeah, we might expect there's something else going on. But first of all, the relevant code location here is for the L2 cup defragmentation. So, and it works like this: if you have a packet that or want to send an L2 cup message that is longer than you can send on the physical layer, for example, you have to fragment it in some way. And so if you send the packet, you say, here's a packet that, or L2 cup packet that is 1,000 byte long, and here you have the first 500 or so, and then the host operating system will then allocate the full 1,000 bytes and keeps track of the offset where the packet or the current packet ends. And then if the next packet arrives, it then copies the payload in the end of the packet and then tries to reassemble it. And The problem here is that the memcopy on a prior Android 10 is really weird when it comes to negative numbers. We hadn't done a full disclosure on this, but it was indeed possible to exploit this bug, at least for Android 10. And here's what how it looks in the end. So you end up with a basically reverse shell with the same privileges as the Bluetooth daemon on Android. And as we then wrote our write-up to report it to Google, we actually had a second look at the master branch, because I had bookmarked for myself the source code for the Android 9 branch, because this is what running on my test device. And then I had a look at the master branch, and as you can see here, there already was a commit that fixes this bug, and it also says directly wrong packet length leading to memory corruption. And this this commit was actually from April 2018, so it was a quite old bug, and it was visible for a couple of months publicly in the master branch, but for some reason it wasn't applied to any releases. As I said before, we built a POC for this. At the point it was fixed, what was in February, it affected around about 60% of the Android devices, so around about 1.5 billion. And we did the disclosure on the 3rd November 2019, and the fix finally came out on February 2020. So even Google requires a full 90 days to basically apply a commit that is already there in the master branch. And we also have here the problem that there are a lot of devices that only receive quarterly updates, so only receive updates every 90 days. And there are still a lot of devices that will not receive updates at all, because the phone is older than 2 years. And then we were also contacted by some automotive vendors, where I am not even sure how their patch cycle looks like. So this is always a problem if you have a chain of different companies. If you report a bug to the first company, they require 90 days to fix it, and then the next company also need 90 days to fix it, and so on. So disclosure of such vulnerabilities can take a long time. And yeah, finally, to my conclusion, exploiting is quite exhausting. So I would like to see if vendors would directly fix memory corruption vulnerabilities without requiring a full remote code execution proof. Like, for example, in the Broadcom case, they found the bug previously, but they didn't supply it any patches. Same for Android. The bug was known, but no patches were supplied. And we still have the problem with patch supply. So there are always unfixable devices. It takes a long time for the patch to reach the customers. And yeah, we have finally released our tool that we've used here, what didn't work quite a bit, that well in this live demo. But if you are interested, here's the source code. It also describes how we exploited the Broadcom vulnerability in the device inquiry, and also some additional information. And that was it from my side, and I would be open for questions. Yep. Okay. Jupp, ich höre dich.
Sind wir auf dem Stream, Regie? Alles klar. So, which heap sanitizer has been used to detect the inquiry bug you mentioned?
This was our own heap sanitizer implementation. So they are using the heap implementation from ThreadX. And we basically reverse engineered the heap, and it's actually quite easy to run some basic checks if the heap is still intact. And then we set hooks on the most interesting functions that will basically test if the heap is still intact, and will throw an error message if there is something wrong. I guess ASLR is not possible on the ARM Cortex M3, I guess they are using. And it's ASLR is something that you really can't use on embedded devices. I guess that DEP, so data execution prevention, could be possible,
Will
but
drop
they had
off
to have to write their
and
firmware
or
images, so
other
their updates
vendors
into the RAM, so it
so
has to be
that
executable at some
the
point, and they should lock it afterwards, but I'm not sure if they will implement it at some point. And Broadcom also now has implemented some sort of heap checks, so and this is, I guess, also why they found the bug yet. But it's not really an exploit mitigation,
we
but more a
power
debug
X
helper.
memory in response to this bug.
That what? Good. So we just counted it. I guess it's around about 100 or 200 hooks that we are using. There are a lot of debugging hooks. But the number of functions that are needed to be replaced are actually not that much. Most important are those functions like writing to an UART regressor, and it's a simple function. It gets a pointer to a buffer and a length, and it writes those data to UART, and you can basically just replace it with a write. Same for UART read. There are some functions that do not make any sense on in the user space. For example, enabling and disabling interrupts. So those are functions that we disabled right away. And let me think. And yeah, there are all those like hardware relevant functions that will, for example, do a read on a hardware register and write on a hardware register. And as long as they can write to a valid memory location, it's probably fine. And if you have this memory state, you also have pretty good default values, so it turned out to work okay-ish. For which one? For the Broadcom exploit, it's in the GitHub repo. So simo-lab/frankenstein. The Android proof of concept is not released yet.